another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Good morning, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and changing economic times, and the things that we can do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. You got me on a Thursday morning, folks. I'm going to probably publish this podcast, I would think, Friday morning, though, just because I've already published today's show from a show I did yesterday, and that's kind of how I've been doing this thing, a day in advance, and trying to get a little bit ahead. So some of my news topics occasionally are not maybe breaking news, but they're a unique opinion of the news, and it gives me time to take in everything that's going on and give those guys a chance to get things out, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about today. But our actual subject today is going to be relocation, and relocation mainly from a city life to a country life, or from a somewhat country life to a true country life, and finding either wilderness land or country land or farmland or some type of rural land, and some different ways to go about getting it done, and some different thoughts and some cautions and some ideas that I have for you. And I'll start out by telling my own personal story about how I've got my relocation plan in motion right now and the things that I did and the way things worked out. Before I do that, though, I've got to talk again a little bit about the presidential race, and I'll try to keep this 2 minutes or less, folks, I promise. But the big news this week is this Paris Hilton video that came out where she refers to John McCain as a wrinkly old white-haired guy or something to that effect. And it's really a response to the video that McCain did with her and I think it was Lindsay Lohan in it, and calling Barack Obama the biggest celebrity in the world and basically insinuating that there was no substance behind his celebrity status. Not going to go there. Not really what's important this week. What's important this week is Paris came out with her own little video, and it seemed like a couple guys kind of knocked on her door and got her to do this, and it's not an endorsement. She didn't get paid to do it or anything. And she made some slams on McCain in the beginning. But as she goes on, she then goes out and lays out an energy policy, and she sums it up with, "I'll see you at the debate. I will see you at the debates, bitches." Bitches being plural. Now, to me, this whole thing's being spun as a slam on McCain, but I actually see it as kind of a slam on the Democrats and the Republicans from someone that maybe I didn't think had the intelligence to pull it off, and maybe I was wrong about Paris, because she did a pretty good job with it. Now, here's the part that's really just chapping my rear end, man. This is making me just pissed off at the media more than normal, including the vaulted bastion of conservatism, the GOP's official news arm of Fox News. Even they're not pointing this out. What's getting the most play out of this video is that Paris Hilton's energy policy she lays out actually makes sense. I'm going to sum it up. I won't get it word for word. I don't use a script myself. But basically, this is what it is. Paris believes that we should do limited offshore drilling with strict environmental controls. She also thinks that we should incentivize Detroit to build new hybrid cars to reduce our dependence on oil in the first place. While they're doing that, we should make efforts to increase our nuclear power production of electricity and heavily invest in alternative energy methods, including wind and solar. You guys can watch her video. Look it up on YouTube, Paris Hilton Energy Policy. I'll find a video on there, and I'll link from this post, the post that goes with the show at thesurvivalpodcast.com for you. And you'll see that I'm pretty damn close to what she said. I mean, almost verbatim, even though it's out of my head, which is kind of scary that what's in her head is now in mine. Anyway, the reason it stuck is when I heard that, I went, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. I think I've heard that somewhere before. You know where I've heard it, folks? From John McCain for the past year. That's John McCain's energy policy. Now, don't think I'm a shill for McCain, because I told you folks before, I'm voting for Bob Barr in the presidential election just to vote against this two-party cabal. I want change, and I don't think I'm going to see it from McCain or from Obama. My fear with these candidates is not so much what they say they're going to do, but what they're actually going to do or not do. And my concern with McCain is I don't think he'll get the things done. But if you go to his website, pull up his energy policy and read it, you'll see that he's the guy that wants to put out money for creating a new battery. to allow hybrid electric cars to do more, that he's always been behind nuclear power, that he's for offshore drilling, but of course he's not for just wide-open, crazy drilling. This is a guy that was really concerned with protecting the Arctic, making sure that any drilling, if ever allowed to be done up there, was done with very strict controls. So, I mean, this is his energy policy, and I'm just waiting for one person, just one person in the freaking media, the mainstream media, to say, wait a minute, yeah, that policy makes sense, but guess whose policy it is? Enough on that. Let's go into our topic. But, folks, go read his website or go listen to some of his speeches on energy and then listen to the Airhead video on the energy policy. You tell me where I'm wrong, that they're not the same policy. All right, let's go on to something that's more about survival and self-sufficiency and practical things that we can all do to start planning for living a better life if times get tougher, even if they don't. So today's topic came in as a suggestion. And unlike some of the other suggestions that I'm doing research and putting together outlines for, as soon as I got the suggestion, I went, that's a great topic. It's something I'm actively doing right now. I'm deep into the process. And because of that, I can just rattle it off. I don't have to do a lot of research on this because it's something I know from real practical, hands-on, direct experience. And again, that's relocation and specifically finding rural land and moving out to it and different methods. And I'm going to give you a bunch of different ideas because I considered many of these and I settled kind of on a path that was put down in front of me. So what I'm actually going to do is start out with telling you the story of how I acquired my piece of land and my little house up north of Hot Springs, Arkansas, that's up on a mountaintop out in the country in unincorporated land, very low property taxes. My property taxes, folks, up there are $360 a year. A year. All right. I wanted to call the tax office and say, if I can lock that in for 10 years, I'll pay you 10 years in advance. That's how great the property taxes are up there. And that's one of the big reasons for relocation. But how did I end up with this land? You're going to listen to this, you're going to go, man, that's kind of just everything fell into place and the guy was lucky. By the time I get to the end about how you do all this research and look for land, you're going to realize that what happens in life is life sticks opportunities in front of you every day. The people that prepare for the right opportunity, when that opportunity comes, are ready to seize it. So what had happened is we had looked for land in Arkansas, all over Arkansas, in fact, up in the northwest corner, up by Bull Shoals Lake, down by Hot Springs. I'd actually traveled to Arkansas several times on my own, driven around, looked at different communities, and got a feel for things. And it really kind of homed in that Hot Springs was a good place because anything you could want from a big city, you could basically get there. But you could live 10 minutes outside of town, and you would feel like you were absolutely in the middle of nowhere. Now, if it was just up to me and I was a single guy, I would already be somewhere in the mountains of Montana or Idaho, and I would have disappeared a long time ago from civilization. But I'm a married man that loves my wife, and I have to make compromises, and she's not big on the, you know, the Daniel Boone theory of if I can see the smoke from my neighbor's chimney, he's too close. Right, she wants community, she wants involvement, she wants places to go down and look at shops and churches and everything else. So we, you know, we had to find a compromise. That ended up becoming the compromise, and we were just going to keep looking until we found the right place. Well, one day the phone rings, and it's my niece, and her husband had lost his job working on helicopters down in South Texas and had just been offered a job, and they were relocating to Hot Springs, Arkansas. So in a matter of a month, I had gone to Hot Springs, had them look at some houses, went back, looked at some houses with them. We selected a place that was affordable for me, that would allow their rent to be affordable, and I bought it. They moved in, and I had them pay me actually a little bit less than the mortgage payment for rent because they were family and I was doing them a favor. They were also doing me a favor because I knew I had a reliable tenant that was going to pay their bills. So I paid up the mortgage payment about $25 a month for the first 3-plus years of the mortgage on that property and home. Now, again, you look at that and go, wow, that's real fortuitous. That's real lucky. But had I not done a lot of the things I'm about to go over with you before that occurred, I wouldn't have been very confident and ready to make that move. If I had not been, you know, smart about the way we ran our finances, because just a year before that, I lost a job that was paying me six figures plus, and I had taken a new job at the time that was paying me significantly less, and I was, you know, laying the groundwork for my own business, and I wasn't the most financially stable person in the world, but I had cash reserves, and that gave me power, and I had a tenant, which meant that once I put my down payment down, I didn't have to be so so concerned about whether or not I could make the mortgage payment. I had some extra money coming in from some of my internet business activities that was enough to cover it if I were to lose them as a tenant anytime in the short term. They since moved out. We go up there about once a month now. And we really enjoy it when we go up there. And I'm going to give you some insights on, you know, remote management of a property when no one's living there and the challenges that come with that and things you have to think about. But I guess my point is that by planning and by being in the process and by doing the things that were free, when it came time to spend money, not only was I was comfortable, but I was capable of spending the money, getting things done, and taking the opportunity that came in front of me. And that opportunity could have took many forms. It may have just been a really beautiful piece of land up there. There's so many different things that it could have been, but that just happened to be what it was, and that's my point. These opportunities will present themselves if you're ready. So here's some of the ways you get ready. I don't think it would surprise anybody that one of the first things I do is suggest you start doing some researching on the internet. And my two favorite resources for that are two websites that I'll link to in the resources section to the notes on this podcast at thesurvivalpodcast.com. One is called United Country. It's at unitedcountry.com. And I warn you, if you pull that thing up at work and start looking at rural properties and all the pictures that go with them and things like that and reading, you might blow your whole day at work and maybe get caught by your boss because you can spend a day there, especially the first time you go, just seeing what's available. And the thing about United Country is they're not a mainstream realtor, which is good because they have a lot of properties listed you may not find through the multiple listing services and things like that, and maybe some creative owner financing options on some properties. And they are really good about posting pictures of property because they know that people are looking there for not just homes but land. So that's what's cool about it. What's not cool about it is I've looked at some comparable properties and found that they're often listing properties for higher than the market will bear. Doesn't mean you can't negotiate it down. I'm just telling you that it's not maybe as inclusive as like multiple listings look up where like there's a lot of houses that are available in that area aren't there. But the beauty of it is it starts to help you hone in on the cities and the towns where affordable property is. You can then take that information and go to the mainstream lookup service called Realtor.com and find a lot more properties in those towns and in those zip codes that have the types of things you're looking for. So those are my two big resources for finding property. And I don't think that's something a lot of people maybe wouldn't know. I mean, the United Country, I've talked to people that haven't heard of that. Realtor.com is pretty well known. Using the two together is very powerful. But let me kind of talk to you about how I see you start using those things. And it depends on what your evac plan or your move-away plan is. If your move-away plan is, I want to get to a point where we have enough money in reserve to, we pick a place, we buy a place, we move, we pull up all stops, we go in one shot, done, the typical move, then it doesn't really matter how far you move other than what you're comfortable with as far as being able to make contact with family and things like that. If you can go anywhere, you can just throw out a very wide net. For a lot of people, I think that my migration path makes sense. What my migration path is to continue working in the city, making as much money as I can, budgeting smartly, paying down the mortgage in the country, and putting in cash reserves to where I can do the changes and the modifications to the structure that I want to do when I get there, and getting to a point where the cost of living there, because I've paid everything down so much, becomes so low that what I have is enough, and that working part-time or doing some internet stuff or freelancing or whatever it is that I choose to want to do, whatever it is my wife chooses to want to do, that when we move up there, maybe we work 20 hours a week and everything else is provided for us through self-sufficiency off the property and the land and the low cost of living. And that, to me, makes a lot of sense for people. If you're doing that, then you do have to kind of limit your range. And to me, that range, our property's right at 5 hours drive. And it's a challenge. It's if it was three, it would be a lot easier. We would go there a lot more often. So if you can find a place that's three, it's better. Five's a stretch. Six, I think you're starting to get to a point where you're not going to go there as often as you should. And you probably need to go there about once a month. So you're looking at taking a Friday off once a month at minimum, or a Monday off and making long weekends and using your long, you know, your Memorial Day, Labor Day weekends and things like that whenever you have them if you push 5 hours. 3 hours, It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a big difference, and it's a lot easier to get off work Friday evening, drive 3 hours, be at your place, stay there Friday night, Saturday, fiddle around Sunday, come home Sunday afternoon. You can leave at, let's say, noon Sunday, be home by 3, take care of the pets and all that good stuff a lot easier than 5, or 5 plus when you're bringing a woman along, which usually makes the trip a little longer, gets more stops. So those are just my thoughts on distance. A lot of you guys have a desire to eventually live off-grid, which means no utilities, no electrical, no city water, no city sewer. I live in an unincorporated area, which is why my taxes are so low, but I am on the electrical grid. I am not on the water grid. I am not on the sewer grid. I cannot get cable television service where I'm at, and I'm lucky that I can get a phone line, all right? And I'm not that far from town. I could be in the middle of downtown Hot Springs in less than 10 minutes if I drive on the dirt road the way I should, maybe 12. Okay, so I'm not that far out of town. It's just that I am up in the mountains, and I am on the end of a dirt road, and, you know, there's only so many people that live back there. Our minimum lot size in that area is 5 acres, which is good because the houses are spread out. We're all friendly with each other, but we don't want to live on top of each other. That's why we've moved there. So that puts me in that situation where I got to put a well and a septic tank in, which makes me independent of the water supply. And I drink very clean water, water that people buy in town, because it percolates through the ground that ends up down in the actual hot springs in the middle of the city. So that's the water we drink out of our sink up there. And that's pretty cool. And so, you know, we have a satellite. Well, we don't have a satellite system. I just have a regular TV antenna until we move there. If I want full TV when we move up there, we'll get a satellite. But the electrical thing, to me, is the most important one that you have to make a decision with. Putting in a well in most locations isn't that hard. It can be expensive if you have a lot of rock to deal with, but it's something that generally can be done. And if people in the area use wells, there's usually people that specialize in it and are able to do it quickly and efficiently. TV service, I mean, who cares? It's satellite, goes anywhere. Can't get DSL, but I can get satellite internet if I wanted a high-speed internet connection for my activities. Those are the types of things like that. But when it comes to electricity, think long and hard before you decide off-grid is the way for you. And here's how I think about off-grid. If you know the kind of structure that you either want to buy or build, and you can find a structure with electricity run to it like that, and you can find one with off-grid like that, you have to put like the solar and wind system in. And if, let's say it's going to cost you $60,000, which is pretty expensive, and that's almost as much as I paid for my home in Arkansas, to give you an idea. But a lot of the systems that are going to do everything you need, you might have to put that much into them. And if what you're going to buy is going to cost you $60,000 to add, you know, the off-grid stuff, and you can buy the stuff that's on-grid for exactly $60,000 more, so it's break-even, we'll go with the off-grid stuff. But as that number declines, as you get a bigger and bigger deficit, you really have to think long and hard. I have some different thoughts for how I can be able to live partially off-grid, and the beauty is that while I have power coming from the grid, I can make this migration as it's available to me. We actually own a mobile home up there, which is part of why we paid so little for the place. But it's a nice 1,800-square-foot, three-bedroom, very, very nice mobile home. But the beauty of that is mobile homes are easy to get underneath and run wiring to different areas of the house. So my plan when I move in is to put in some photovoltaic panels up on the roof, use a 12-volt direct current power without an inverter, because you get a lot more efficiency that way, and begin doing things like putting in lighting that runs directly off the 12-volt source so that I can begin to take my lighting needs off of a 12-volt source. So you get a 12-volt air conditioner, window unit type system, put that in our bedroom, and at night when we go to sleep, go ahead and turn that on and run that through the night with the door closed, and we're only cooling that small bedroom, and then let the automatic thermostat come way up in the summer nights up there and let the temperature in the rest of the house come up a little bit and it push it back down. Now, I've told you before, I'm not living without AC. But running a full AC on an 1,800-square-foot home on photovoltaic is damn near impossible. So this is a way to begin to augment that usage back and forth, and to possibly eventually get some type of a refrigeration unit that can, when necessary, run off of 12 EDC so that we have a power failure that we can, you know, get by during that power failure with some of our food without having to cook it all and without losing it all. So that's kind of like, that would be impossible to do if I was off-grid. And it's a very slow migration. Now, once I get all that stuff in place, it's a very simple process from there to continue to add more panels over time, to maybe put in wind generation, to eventually add an inverter, and maybe eventually take the home off-grid completely or to a point where I'm producing 80% or more of my own power. That migration path is a very slow, easy, pay-as-you-go method, and it makes a lot of sense to me. So you have to make your own decisions about that, but that's really, really something I think you should consider. One of the big suggestions I have for you is go visit first. Part of the reason I was so willing to get up there and move on my opportunity was I had been to Hot Springs a couple times. Go there, stay there, take a long weekend there. Especially if you're doing the migration path like I am, where you're going to be actually having two residences for a while. If you're doing that, then it makes a lot of sense to, you know, pick a place, because then you'll get the experience of driving there. What's the cost of driving there? What's the inconveniences? Do you have to board pets? Can you take your pets? Different things like that. Get a decent hotel, stay in the area, go into the little towns, look at the communities, look at property that's available, get local newspapers, look at what's being advertised, see what the employment situation's like. Try to live there a little bit, sort of, so to speak. Take a week vacation there if you have the ability to do so. And don't do all the tourist stuff on that vacation. Take time to live, you know, go eat in the little local restaurants, maybe visit a local church, whatever it is that's important to you. Do those things as though you lived there, as though you had just moved there, and you'll start to get a feel for the place, and you'll know if it's right. And if it's not right, start looking somewhere else. Another thing I could tell you is find a good creative realtor once you've decided you want to look there. I found a really good real estate agent quickly in Hot Springs area. She worked really hard for me. She drove me all over the place showing me different properties. We looked from 15 miles south of the city to 15 miles north of the city to 15 miles west of the city, which is a pretty good circle of range to look and be driven around by a realtor who knows she's going to sell you a house that's going to be well under $100,000. She's only going to make so much money off that, but she did it. She worked hard. She helped me find a bank that was comfortable financing mobile homes with conventional mortgage rates, so I didn't have to pay an additional mortgage rate even though it was a mobile home. And she even found me a good insurance agent that was used to putting insurance on mobile homes. So that went a long way. So I can't overstate the value of a good real estate agent. You might want to listen to my podcast on hiring a financial advisor. I'm not quite as tough on a real estate agent, but some of those concepts and ideals help you keep your mind right when you're looking for one. Another thing I have to tell people is don't focus on the house. Focus on the land. The land is what will provide for you. Now, if it's a house, it's a complete pit that's going to cost a ton of money to fix, you got to take that into consideration, but your main focus needs to be on the land. I watch like house hunters, I watch people look at houses out in the country, and they're worried about the color of the paint, or that the carpet's old, or that the window's not quite the kind of window they want. You can change all that. If you buy a piece of land that's too small, if you buy a piece of land that sucks, that won't produce for you, that can't be made to produce for you, if you buy a bad piece of land, you can't change the land. So focus on the land and what the land can provide for you. That's going to really help you a lot. If you could find land that's close to government land, like national forest, state forest, Bureau of Land Management land, state game lands, anything like that, a lot of you guys that want to live in the country, you want to be able to walk in the woods and, you know, do things like that. And, you know, we're just up the street from Hot Springs National Park. So there's just tons of hiking trails around Hot Springs where we can hike and go all kinds of places. And then just a few miles north of us is the Washington National Forest, which is so big that it actually spreads from where we live all the way to the Oklahoma border, and all that land is wide open and available to us. It was a big part of our decision to go there. Sometimes you can actually find property that's on a border to government land, where maybe you only have 3 or 4 acres, but maybe your land is on a 100-acre parcel of state game land. If you have that, you know, you can deal with hunters, but hunters are usually pretty good people, and most of my listeners probably want to do a little hunting or fishing themselves, or national forest or state forest or things like that. We couldn't quite pull that one off. But that's really cool because it basically turns your 4-acre lot into a 4-acre lot for your self-sufficiency needs with hundreds or thousands of acres of land for you to walk and roam and play on. And that's really cool, so that's something to look for. Think really hard about water. If you're buying a piece of land where you're actually going to build your own structure there, create your own house, buy a mobile home, whatever it is that you're going to do, think about water. Find out what it's going to cost to put a well in, if there isn't a well already, or if there isn't county or city water available to you. Even if there is city water available to you, if you want to be self-sufficient, still get pricing on a well, just add that to the price of buying the property right from the beginning. Immediately know what that's going to be before you buy the property. Don't get your pricing on something like that after you do it. You know, the other thing is, find out what your taxes on the property are going to be after you buy the house. This is a mistake we made when we bought the house we live in here in Texas now. I would have bought it anyway, but it would have been nice to know. The property taxes the existing owner were paying were very, very low, but they were based on the price that they had paid for the property when they bought it new 13 years ago. And it had only been very mildly adjusted upward with appreciation. The day I bought it, the appreciation went to the price that I paid for it, and my taxes went way up. So go down to the tax office that's going to cover that piece of property that you're thinking about buying. Tell them, hey, I'm thinking about buying this property. This is what I would pay for it. How's that going to affect my taxes? Are you going to raise them up? If so, what's your tax rate, and what am I going to be paying? Don't think that, you know, that's going to be, you know, kind of tipping your hand to the dealer, because they're going to know when you buy the land. So you're not telling them anything they're not going to find out anyway. You're finding out something you're not going to find out anyway. So get that information and calculate that into the cost of your property. There's also something called, if you're going to mortgage this property, and many people will have to, private mortgage insurance, primary mortgage insurance, and they're also known as PMI. Now, PMI can be avoided by making a larger down payment. Generally, if you make 20% of a down payment in your mortgage, you don't have to pay PMI. You can also do like an 80-20 mortgage where you do an 80% mortgage for 30 years and a 20% mortgage for 10 or 20 years. And that's okay if that's what you want to do. I really don't like that. I like to have one mortgage payment. I think it's a lot cleaner. So here's my deal on PMI. Calculate how much PMI is going to be. And say, if I go 20% on the property versus whatever it was I was going to put down, how many years will it take before not paying the PMI will make up the down payment? For instance, when I bought the property in Arkansas, I was comfortable with a 10% down payment that got me the terms that I wanted. It put me, you know, with some equity in the property right from the beginning, got my payment where I wanted it. Everything was good with a 10% down payment. That was not good enough to get out of the primary mortgage insurance. But with a low-cost property, my PMI up there was only like $40. And I realized that in 2 years, I could have the place appraised if I had 20% of equity in it then, which I knew I would, I could get out of PMI. So it would only take me 2 years to get out of it. The time it would have took for it to pay itself back if I had put another 10% down on the property was 14 and a half years. 14 and a half years. So obviously I stuck with a 10% down payment on that. On our property here in Texas, the PMI was a lot higher because the property was higher, and I was in kind of a creative financing situation, so I went ahead and did a 20% down payment on that property, and we don't pay PMI on it at all. That's kind of nice as well. So those are just some ways to think about PMI. I'm not going to do anything on mortgages today. Just let me say it very simple. There are three types of mortgages for you to consider. There's 15-year fixed, there's 20-year fixed, and there's 30-year fixed. Do not do adjustables, do not do interest-onlys, do not do short-term, do not do hybrids, don't do anything like that. Fixed, 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 and the shortest term that you can comfortably make the payments for is probably the best one for you to do. Now you have to start thinking about this. If you do what I'm doing, and you buy a property that you only get to go to once a month or once every 6 weeks or something like that, and you are in a situation I'm in now, I no longer have a tenant, you know, the best thing you can do is hire a neighbor. throw them $50 a month or something like that. Give them keys to your place, have them go by your place, say, hey, just go by it once a day, look inside, make sure nobody's stolen anything, make sure nobody's broken in, that type of thing, and call me if anything's wrong. Here's my numbers. Here's how to get a hold of me. If they tell you they'll do it for free, give them the $50 anyway. It will go a long way when you eventually move there. They won't feel like you've taken advantage of them, and people tend to, you know, stay on top of a job that they're paid for, and they tend to, like, drive, ah, it's good enough today. I'm not going to go inside. So if you throw them a few bucks, they're more likely to pay a little bit more attention to it. And, you know, let you know when things are going on, like, hey, your overgrowth is getting a bit excessive here, because then you can say, you know what, I'm not going to be able to get up there. Could you call somebody for me and could you give me a number I can call? Find somebody there for me that I can use to do some weeding for me or something like that. So it's good to have some eyes on the ground and find a good trustworthy neighbor. Give them a little bit of a stipend, and that'll really go a long way. Now, I want to talk a little bit, just a brief bit about building options. I won't go too deep into that because that's probably a whole show in itself as well. But basically, when you look at moving to the country permanently, you have two types of structures, a permanent structure and a mobile home. And, you know, there's cabins, there's typical site-built homes, there's timber frame homes, there's all of these different things. But basically, you're either building a house or you're doing a mobile home. The advantages, there's advantages to each. One, a site-built home will have a lot more appreciation. It's absolutely a better investment. The other side of things is that a mobile home is easy and quick and fast. It's something that you can put in very, very quickly. Generally, setup fees are included in the cost. Basic setup, pushing a flat piece of land out for you and stuff like that are very affordable as well. As long as you have a place to tie into, you know, a septic tank or a sewer, a well or city water, and an electrical grid, the day your home is delivered, you can move into it and live in it. That's pretty cool. If you're buying one that's already there, generally, since they, unfortunately, for the people that buy them new, depreciate, you can generally get a pretty good deal on buying a piece of land that already has a mobile home on it. But for investment purposes, there's no question that a site-built home is better. So you have to make that determination for yourself. The thing about a mobile home is if you want to be creative with solar power and things like that, while the insulation's a little bit lacking, running wires to do, let's say, two parallel systems, one from the grid and a 12 VDC system is easy. You pull the skirting back, you get a flashlight, you go under there, and you can run wires and cables and electrical equipment anywhere you want to. So there's an advantage there as well. So you got to kind of make your own decision with that. Another option, though, would be to find a place with like a little kind of dilapidated mobile home that's something you could live in if you had to, or something you definitely wouldn't mind staying in on weekends. You know, maybe it's kind of small and cramped and kind of a little bit tattered, but you could use it as a base of operations while you built a permanent home. That's an option. Another option is you buy a piece of land, you buy a travel trailer, you pull your travel trailer onto your land, you hook into your electrical, you hook into your water and sewer, and you build your home and live in your travel trailer. That's something in my neighborhood up in Arkansas, I guess you'd call it more of a community than a neighborhood, it's too spread out to be a neighborhood. A lot of people have done that. Now, we have very few restrictions in that area. One is that a dwelling can only exist on 5 acres or more. So if you buy a 7-acre lot up there, you can't build two houses on it. You have to buy at least a 10-acre lot to build two houses on it. I like that, again, because it keeps the houses spread out. That's the whole point. We want that up there. A dwelling must be a permanent structure. You can use a mobile home, but it can't be on blocks or on wheels. It's got to be set up into a point where it's got to be, you know, it's designed for living permanently. So that's one of the other restrictions. Composite roof, have to have shingled roof on them. It can't be like some kind of plywood shack that you put together with some corrugated steel on it. And that's really about the only restrictions that we have. So you can't pull a travel trailer in there and live. But what is allowed is living in a travel trailer while construction is being done. So a lot of people have taken that. So that's another thing to consider as you're looking at your land. Is there any restrictions? I know a lot of people say, I don't want any restrictions. But that's a two-way street, folks. I like the few restrictions that we have in our community, because it prevents somebody from buying, you know, 10 acres behind me and putting 10 houses on it and ruining that open land, all those woods, all those other things. So I like those restrictions, but you want to make sure that they're not too restrictive. You know, and those restrictions are part of a little tiny homeowners group there that's been designed so that it can't really grow or run away with power, and just the people that live there are not going to be the kind of people that say, I want to worry about what color your fence is. Right? These are people that have moved away to get away. So the only restrictions there are to keep the land as close to the way that it is now as possible and still make it comfortable for people to live on. So that's been the way that's worked out. I've liked that. So that's something else to consider as well. So those are kind of some thoughts on just your different building options. On making the move, there's a lot of ways to do that, and you have to decide whether you're just going to actually pull up and go in one sweep, or you're going to do it over time. I really like the way we're doing this. Every time we go up there, we look for things that we want to keep, but we haven't used for a while, and that we're not going to use anytime soon, and we just take them with us, so that by the time we actually pull a big truck in to move, a lot of stuff will already have been taken up there. So we're doing that slowly over time, and when it comes time for the move, once we list our house for sale, we'll be able to, you know, like weekly go up there for a couple days, just let the realtor take care of doing her job down here, and slowly make the move. That's an option for us. You don't have, generally when you pull up stakes and go, like somebody's moving into your house, you got to get the heck out. That's what we had in Pennsylvania. That's what we had when we moved from here to Pennsylvania for a few years. It was like, we got to go right now. We had to get some help, different things like that. In this case, it's going to be a much easier move, so that's something to consider when you're considering the way that you're actually going to make this move. So that kind of wraps up my thoughts on this. And this show has given me a lot of ideas for future shows. So I'm going to do some shows in the future. Maybe I'll just do a show on mobile home living, finding good mobile homes. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, if like finding a used, crappy mobile home is a temporary structure, or even maybe refurbishing one. I wanted to talk about having like multiple structures on your land instead of one, like putting in little outbuildings that are actually places you can go do stuff as an office, or for if you have kids and you homeschool, like making a little schoolhouse, and how using multiple structures can let you do more with alternative energy sources because you're heating or cooling or lighting smaller areas. So those are all great topics. I'll try to do future shows on those, but that wraps it up for today. This is kind of a long one, but I think it was an interesting one. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Remember, comments, questions, suggestions at the blog at www.thesurvivalpodcast.com. I've had people asking about my email. Just go to the blog and use the Contact Us form on our blog. There's a link on the right that says Contact Us. Click that. Use that form to contact me. I will respond to you. You will then have my personal email. I don't mind giving it out. I just don't like being spammed, and I get about 400 spam emails a day. That's why I don't publish my email address. So that's how you'll get in touch with me if you don't want to just make comments on any of the episodes. And keep your suggestions coming. And remember, here at the Survival Podcast, we're going to help you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream, and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.